black and white.
La degradación del medio ambiente.
In general, environmental degradation is a phenomenon of our times. The types of economy and production cause these catastrophic events. There is also one more reason: how humans have interacted with natural resources. Undoubtedly, humans are an integral part of the environment. Humans impact the environment. The environment is meaningless without the human being who values it, takes care of its quality, and ensures its existence. But in the case of humans, we don't talk about them in abstract terms. We're talking about humans who form societies with certain characteristics, with forms of production, with social, economic, and cultural aspects. They harm a number of humans in some cases and benefit a minority. According to data from the United Nations, in 2016, 90% of the wastewater in developing countries, without being processed, flows into rivers and lakes. This same United Nations report also states that in that same year of environmental crisis, 2016, approximately 7 million people died worldwide due to climate issues. The World Health Organization, WHO, states that in the last decade, 95% of natural catastrophes have caused a total of 600,000 deaths, of which 95% belong to poor countries. The issue is how we can achieve environmental justice that is closely related to social justice with a paradigm shift, with a change in society, a change in the relationship between the production, distribution, and uses of natural resources. How are science and technology used at the service of environmental quality? Because our treatment of the environment has impacts on us as well. Humans are a part of environment. For the same reason, there aren't any contradictions nor struggles between humans and the environment. Such an opinion is absurd and absolutely false. We shall consider it as a whole. We can only speak of an environmental change to the extent that there is a social change and a change in the relations of production and profit. We should realize how development is closely related to the sustainable nature of the environment. According to science and technology, we need a sustainable and transformable environment for development and for the benefit of quality of life. Ultimately, we are aware, at least on our part, that the environment is the common home of humans and all the species that live in it. But indisputably, humans are the ones who value it the most. We are humans, and it is our responsibility to take care of environmental quality. Today, profound transformations of a social nature are being proposed, without which there is no environmental change, without which there cannot be a favorable environment for the majority or for humanity as a whole. The liberation of humanity as a whole depends on environmental change. I'm Eduardo Artes. This is Black and White. Today in our program, I talk to Cristobal Rodriguez. He's an environmental activist and advocate. He's also a member of an organization which has a very long name. Please introduce yourself and the organization.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Eduardo. I'm a member of Movement for the Defense of Access to Water, Land and Environmental Protection.
Bienvenido, Cristobal.
You are very welcome to our program. What is the role of environmental movement on the international, national, and Latin American levels? What is the relationship between this movement and the proposals for social transformation, together with the trade union movements, social movements, villagers, indigenous people, etc.
Your first question is very interesting because we're currently experiencing an unprecedented climate crisis. These organized movements can come up with suggestions in face of socio-environmental conflicts. The whole world is affected by this crisis. We cannot allow life on Earth to be at these critical levels. We have observed different international reports that tell us about the increase in temperatures throughout the world. This undoubtedly has repercussions. For example, regarding trade unions, it affects all productive activities that are based on some natural resources. Talking about fishing, when the temperature rises in the ocean, there is less diversity in the sea. In agricultural terms, there is a shortage of rainfall. Global warming and climate change also affect the mining. That is why it is a global movement.
Perfecto, pero...
Well, is there any conflict of interest between environmental and trade union movements? Imagine that one of these causes environmental contamination. I know that there are many reasons. For instance, the companies don't spend the amount of money needed or many other ones. But sometimes there is an inconsistency between environmental and trade union movements. I think that this problem is related to everyone.
Of course, we also have to understand that we, as humans, workers of labor unions and companies, are parts of an ecosystem. We shall have a permanent and careful dialogue. In the environmental movement in Chile, we have realized that if we are not capable of taking care of our natural resources, we cannot have a job. Cities are becoming unsustainable over time. So I think that before addressing the extent of work, we must face the dimension of sustainable living. There are going to be waves of migrations due to climate change. We witnessed that phenomena in Central America. Climate change decreases the amount of cultivation, and that is why this amount of population has to immigrate to find sources of work. We should not exclusively look at it just as a contrast between things, but it is a more complementary phenomenon.
We shall consider it as a model of a different society. When the Industrial Revolution develops, it obviously creates a type of relationship formed from environmental defects that include well-being of the workers, young people, children, etc. Who suffers? A large number of people, while others aren't harmed.
That's right. We know that the climate crisis is going to affect the poorest populations in the world. But we also have to highlight the responsibility of great producing powers in this same crisis. So there's an expansion of certain economies during the Industrial Revolution, which affects countries like Chile. The climate crisis impacts third world countries and countries in the global south as well. If we consider the world or the planet Earth as a system, we cannot allow it to continue happening. Any transformation or change within an ecosystem has repercussions in all parts. We're not the only ones who face water crisis. Water crisis has repercussions in local, regional, national, subcontinental, and continental development, and ultimately the entire world. This development model has caused a very serious problem.
This development model causes a serious problem. There are some cases at the international level that different sectors of society, along with workers who were interested in the environmental issue, could come together and raise their voices. It happened in Argentina and Europe. We are in Chile right now. Did we have such an experience? Was there any unanimous voice in defense of the environment that considered the quality of life of all the people?
Claro, es importante eso que señala porque
this point is very important. Most of the time our general conception is that the environmental issue doesn't have political, economic and social aspects. When we talk about the environmental issue, all these variables are included. For instance, in case of Chile, the largest holders of capital like Luxic Group and Angelini Group generate their wealth from the possession of natural resources. In this scenario, we face an economic problem. Recently, we witnessed the Corpesca case. Jaime Orpiz is released from his pretrial detention due to the fishing law. That is why natural resources have a political component. We highlight these social problems when we talk about the poorest population in Chile that has a productive field essentially based on monoculture. So the first thing we have to do is generate those visions and stop thinking that the environmental issue isn't related to the political, social and cultural aspects. What kind of experience do we have in Chile? I think that we live in a country where neoliberalism emerged in the most radical way. For example, as a movement, we have the governance of Valparaíso, that is the second largest region in Chile. So we question this centralism by occupying the institutions for the decentralization of the country. This is a vivid example to reverse these failed development model policies.
It is a development model proven to be unsuccessful. This model actually doesn't benefit the people. Let's have a break, and then we continue our program immediately.
Continuamos en negro y blanco.
We continue our talk in black and white with Cristobal Rodriguez, who is an environmental defender. As a member of this environmental movement, what do you think about this discrepancy between development and developmental sustainability according to social conceptions? I believe that humans are the ones that determine everything in the end. I mean that everything is related to them, who are in the center of everything.
Your question is very interesting because it represents a paradigm shift. It also helps us to stop thinking that growth and development are unlimited. We must put the limit to growth. We've been in the ecological overshoot of planet Earth for a couple of weeks. This means that we are almost following the neoliberal principles of living in debt. As a movement, we believe that we have to start talking about a new economic model to replace the current one. This new economic model should not question sustainability of life on Earth, the respect of human rights, and the conservation not only of the species, but also of our indigenous people. So we come to realize that humans are a part of the whole, and we are not necessarily the most important component of this system.
We are not the most important ones?
No necesariamente.
Not necessarily. We shall consider ourselves as complementary entities within this system. It's not the theory of the system. The span of species are not important in this system. We are equally important in this system. I insist on the word system because we cannot consider things in an individualistic way, but rather a part of the whole.
Individualista, sino como parte de un todo.
De acuerdo.
Perfect. The point is about the development of existence of rational and conscious humans who value the environment. The environment exists because humans value, recognize, and feel it. Humans are a part of the environment. Whatever happens to the environment has impacts on humans as well, and vice versa. However, humans have the ability to transform the environment. They started this transformation from early times to today. We should not only consider the recent years in this case, but it is not possible for humans to transform and recreate the environment according to their needs. It actually does not mean going backwards, but rather a leap forward in an evolutionary chain.
Eso podría haber sido durante el siglo XX.
Yes, it could have happened during the 20th century. Regarding the 21st century, we can mention a chapter of our 2022 Constitution that was rejected. This chapter spoke of the rights of nature, so we must have an equal understanding before the law. Without people, the nature has to be defended or have access to equal judgment. There's a period in which people stop having an anthropocentric vision in the 20th century, and then they believe that humans are a fundamental part of this transformation, but not the only part. I need to emphasize that humans are not the most important ones. If we extrapolate to other values, for example, democratic ones, we understand that in nature these new democratic forms that we need are replicated in the most precise and perfect way. Therefore, we do not necessarily need to be the greatest force, but rather we have to learn to dialogue, share, learn and question what is provided for us by others. All of these points ultimately make up this new paradigm. We believe in it and work for it.
Yes, of course, but finally humans are the ones that will represent non-human interests within nature. And these are the same humans that make legislations for such interests. Humans will provide opportunities for other humans. In short, I believe that it is the human being, the subject and owner of everything. Humans are an indisputable part of the environment. We actually don't destroy the environment, but we damage our own lives. Undoubtedly, human being needs the environment, so he needs a society that generates a certain type of quality and dignity of life. But the human being is the one who decides and determines the transformation. He can even determine the creation of artificial lakes and mountains. He can determine everything. But it does not mean that he is destroying nature, because nature itself is something that is constantly changing, even without the presence of human being.
Eduardo, under this vision, how does a river return to its source? Here, the role of water is very important. It is no human intervention for a river to flow again where it has flowed for thousands of years.
There are physical and material conditions that determine water under a certain type of amount of accumulation, rain or snow, to have a certain path. Humans have to study this process scientifically, respect it, take it into account, and not build in surrounding areas to prevent catastrophes. Humans should not create an unsuitable environmental situation, because at the end of the day, it impacts all aspects of our life. We have to bear in mind that it profoundly affects the poorest and vulnerable people, because they're the ones who build their houses along the river banks. In short, nature has its course, and humans have to learn from it by achieving necessary science and technology. Human beings must use nature in terms of respect, not the way people are using it right now, which is so bad, because otherwise we destroy our quality of life. This is the relation that exists between human beings and nature.
It could be considered a fallacious premise that the technology has no limits in its development. This has been proved wrong. We still haven't been able to reach full technological potential in a lot of things.
But technological and scientific capabilities are everlasting and will continue until the last day.
Not necessarily. There are certain natural resources that cannot be recovered.
This is a different issue.
For us, it is part of the same thing, because we understand this as a systemic thought. For instance, we implement extractive projects and deplete natural resources like copper, molybdenum, gold, and lithium. This technical and technological development will end someday. We must pay attention to the fact that close to 70% of the water used at the mine's sites cannot be recovered, not even for human consumption. We're setting scientific limits on these technical, economic, and social developments.
Cristóbal,
In these few minutes that are left for us, please explain to us the major challenges that you see in the environmental movement in view of this great social upheaval, exclusively with the danger of a world war.
Probably the majority of your audience is in Chile, so the first change we face in Chile today is related to the access to water. In our country, there are 300,000 people who do not have access to water. It's a challenge that bears relations to human rights and quality of life. If we extrapolate this issue to a global context, we're seeing that the current climate crisis is going to cause a number of changes in ways of life that are inevitably going to lead to higher levels of conflict. We shall be capable of observing such dangerous signs. We don't need to foresee, because the disaster is in front of our eyes. The problem is that we don't see it every day. For instance, the temperature rises to a certain degree that the body of the human being can't tolerate anymore. But the planet as a whole can put up with that. We have to be aware of the disasters. I think that it is the second challenge that we face nowadays. As I mentioned in the beginning of our conversation, we have to be able to understand the system as a whole. We should understand this socio-environmental conflict beyond environmental activism, union policies, and the care system. This is the most major challenge in our times, where certain identity politics is imposed. We have to look at this again in a systemic and complementary way in which each part functions as a micro-universe but at the same time influences what happens around it.
Is it possible to improve the quality of the environment by continuing with the current social, economic, and political systems that exist in most countries?
It's absolutely impossible, because these systems caused this crisis.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Cristobal. I hope you continue your work in the environmental movement. Until next time on Black and White.
Thank you, Eduardo. I wish you the best.
Thank you. علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة. The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of prophethood based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And we are currently focusing on the first sermon, and here Imam Ali alayhi salam discusses some intricate details regarding the issue of prophethood. And one of the discussions that he has is about the final prophet or the seal of the prophets, who was the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala sent him so that he can fulfill the divine promise. And we say the divine promise is the promise that the prophetic trend and the whole prophetic teachings in totality, the trend of prophethood is going to overwhelm all other trends that exist in the universe, that exist in the world. And the overcoming is such that they are naturally so pure, so amazing, so much helpful in the problems of the people, in solving the problems of the people. They are so innovative and powerful in causing a change in human existence that they naturally overwhelm all other schools of thoughts. And all other schools of thoughts kind of, they lose power and strength in front of them. This is the meaning of that. Now, how does this get manifested in the finalization of the prophethood, inshallah? We shall discuss this in the coming segment.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, we say that human beings, they always try to present different schools of thought and social systems to bring them out of a problem, a blockade that doesn't allow them to progress. And the human mind is so innovative that it can sometimes present good solutions to these problems. But at the same time, when it comes to the teachings of the prophets, these actually, they find the root of the problem and they solve the problem in its original way, in an essential way that causes true growth and upliftment. And as such, whenever in a society there was for example, a school of thought that was brought forth by mankind, and another school of thought that was the result of prophetic teachings, this school of thought, which is the result of prophetic teachings, overwhelmed the other schools of thought naturally. Not by force, not by, forcefully shoving down this idea into the throats of the people. Not like that. Of course, there had been wars and fights, and many times even in these wars and fights the true path overwhelmed the false path. But this is not what we're discussing yet. We're talking about that light of these true teachings that naturally outshine all the other kinds of schools of thoughts. Coming back to what we were discussing, you see, at the time of the prophets, like the previous prophets, like Prophet Musa, like Prophet Ibrahim, they even came up with these schools of thought that were divine in nature. But you can realize that at that time, mankind had not progressed so much in terms of their ability to understand their structures, social structures and everything. And therefore, the schools of thought that were brought and the ways of working, the Sharia that was brought at those times, were there. Were not the perfect forms of Sharia. They were, you can say, a little bit imperfect because of the fact that the communities had not yet reached that level so that they can accept the full and complete Sharia. And as such, it is possible that later on, maybe after centuries, another school of thought that was brought by a man, by a human being, would be such that it would be stronger and more, you can say, refined than the teachings of a prophet. It is possible and plausible to think like that.
IRIB English Radio presents a detailed commentary of the Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, on the program Gate of Knowledge.
Now, you will be surprised that, okay, this is a very big claim that is being made, that the teaching of a human being or the ways of thinking of a human being can for example, be more refined than the teachings of a prophet? Yes, we are talking about the previous prophets who did not come with the most perfect Sharia. So let me give you an example. There's a car race, there's a race track, and there are several cars, right? All of them are racing towards a destination. And one of the cars, let's say we call it the car of prophethood, right? This car of prophethood, it is on gear one, it goes into gear two, and then stops at gear three. It doesn't go ahead, like it doesn't change the gear. It goes on in the same, gear, at gear number three, let's say. The other cars that are around there, they, for example, they start to go gear one, gear two, gear three, and then they enter into gear four and gear five, and they would naturally overtake the car of prophethood. You see, because the final teachings, the final gear of prophethood was not brought in, you cannot now say that the other schools of thought are more advanced than the prophetic teachings. The final gear of the prophetic teachings has to be brought in so that it can then be compared by the other schools of thought. So at the time of Nabi Musa alayhi salam, let's say it had reached gear 3. It is possible that the other cars, they advance in such a way that they enter their fifth gear and they overtake the teachings of the Prophet. And of course, they may have even made use of some of the teachings of Nabi Musa alayhi salam to come to that conclusion. What we are saying here is that it is possible that a specific period of time after certain teachings of the Prophet have been there for a specific period of time and for a specific group and for a specific era, later on humans come up with another school of thought that could be a little bit advanced. That doesn't mean that other school of thought is more advanced than the general prophetic trend, because the prophetic trend has not yet given its best yet. It was because of the society at that time that the prophets had to limit the Sharia to a certain degree. Inshallah, we shall come to discuss about this in the next session as to how the final prophetic teachings are beyond what human beings can ever achieve. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
This is the Heart of Life pounding IRIB English Radio.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
I want to share a short story before I begin the speech for tonight. It's something which is one of the stories which really shakes you up. It's from Shahid Mutahhari, rahmatullahi alayhi. He says that one of my teachers, once when he was about to give the class, he was just, disturbed, and it seemed like he was crying. And he said that, "Today I'm not going to be able to give the class, I'm sorry. because I'm disturbed about a dream that I saw last night. What was the dream? He says that I saw that I had passed away. My soul was going to be taken away from my body. Everyone had gathered to accompany my body and to put it in the grave. And as I was being lowered into the grave, I saw that there was a dog that was going to join me in the grave. And whatever I did to shoo away the dog, I couldn't do anything because I didn't have the power to do so. I had died. And I saw that it was going to come with me in the grave and it was going to be disturbing me a lot in the grave. And I was frightened. And at that moment, I saw that there was the presence of someone who came to my grave. And he ordered the dog to go away and it went away. And I asked him who he was and he says that I am Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And he says, I came to understand that that dog was the representation of the undue anger that I was having towards my family members. And when I woke up, I realized that this whole dream and everything that was there, it was all a lesson for me. What was the lesson? The lesson is that Imam Hussein alayhi salam is there to help us. And when we have opportunities like this in this world to come to these gatherings, we're here to really think about how we can make our lives be more Husseini, more like Imam Hussein alayhi salam. His martyrdom is an opportunity for us to identify those places where we can change, rectify, modify, inshallah improve, so that he will be there with us when we leave this world and he will be there and be happy to receive us, inshallah. The example that I'd like to begin with today from history, because we're taking lessons from history, because as Imam Ali alayhi salam says that innal umura ashbah, the history repeats itself. Things that happened in the past can come up again. The example that I have, I want to take you to a personality known as Zubair ibn Awam. Zubair, like Talha from yesterday, was somebody who was very famous in the history of Islam. He was the fourth or fifth person to accept Islam. He was tortured because of his beliefs. He fought alongside the Prophet. One time, he was traveling with somebody and that person saw that his entire body was covered with battle scars. You know, imagine like somebody, let's say you might see somebody that's covered with tattoos. His body was covered with battle scars. And his companion asked him, he says that, where'd you get all these scars from? He says that every one of these I got from battling alongside the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. This is the type of, you know, support he gave to the Prophet. He was one who drew his sword when he was present at the house of Fatima alayhi salam, defending the rights of Imam Ali alayhi salam against those who would want to, let's say, burn down the house of Fatima alayhi salam. That's how much support he had given to the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. But we see that things changed for him just like they changed for Talha. Yesterday we saw that that same Talha who was carrying the blessed body of the Prophet and protecting him from injury in the Battle of Uhud is the same one who draws his sword against the very soul of the Prophet, meaning Amir al-Mu'mineen. Things changed for people. And the same thing happened with Zubair. That history shows that at the end of his life, he is on the opposite side of the battlefield in the Battle of Jamal. Now there's a point during this battle, which I want to focus on, inshallah, this is going to be an introduction to our topic, where Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam says to Zubair, let's have a conversation. You know, they're relatives. They have a long history. And he tells Zubair that, I want to remind you of an incident that took place when we were young. Do you remember that day that we were children and we were playing together and you were hugging me? And our Prophet was there with us and he asked you, do you love him? And he said, of course I love him. Right? He's my brother, he's my cousin, I love him. So then the Prophet told you at that time, then why is it that at one point you will be fighting him and you will be the one who is the unjust one? And at that point, you didn't accept this. You said this would never be the case. And when Zubair heard this from Imam Ali alayhi salam, then he said, "Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un." You reminded me of something that I had forgotten about. And he walks away determined to not fight against Imam Ali alayhi salam. What happens at this point? This is really crucial. At this point, as he walks back to his army, he apparently looks like, that's it, he's not going to fight anymore. But he's met by his son, Abdullah ibn Zubayr. Abdullah tells him that, "My father, you know, you went away looking like something and now you look like something else. Tell me what happened." So he tells him the incident. He says, "I'm not going to fight anymore." And his son begins to instigate him. He tells him, for example, he says to him that, you know, "You're the one who brought these people here and you created this division and now you're going to just walk away? How could you do that? It seems to me that you're a coward." And then he tells to his father, he says that, "You know, you'll be the laughing stock of the Arabs, and you know, all the women will talk about how much of a coward you were if you're going to walk away from this." And then finally, Abdullah tells him that, "Okay, you made a bay'ah to Imam Ali alayhi salam, then just give a kafara, give a penalty, and it'll be okay. You can break your allegiance with the Imam alayhi salam." So that's what Zubair does. He breaks his allegiance. He goes and he fights against the Imam alayhi salam, and eventually he's killed in the battle. Who is this person, Abdullah ibn Zubayr? Abdullah, his son, was somebody who throughout the life of Zubair was a source of, he was an issue for him. And one hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he says that Zubair was from us, the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, until his son grew up. When his son grew up, that's when he started showing enmity towards us. So Imam alayhi salam puts the problem on the son. But when we go back in history, it's very interesting. And we look at the childhood of Abdullah ibn Zubayr, we see that Abdullah grew up in a broken home. What exactly happened is not very clear, but one of the reports say that Zubair, the father, was somebody who used to beat his wife, who was the mother of Abdullah. And when Abdullah, as a child, saw that his father was beating his wife, he took a stand. And he said that, "Okay, that's it. This is not going to happen anymore." And somehow he managed to create some type of division between his mother and his father, and eventually they were separated. Now, when you look at it from, you know, now at a distance, and we try to see exactly the factors and put together things, sometimes we just have to work off of, you know, things which are not necessarily concrete evidence. But definitely when you look at all the things together, you can see that one of the factors that led to Abdullah ibn Zubayr becoming one of the arch enemies of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, eventually he'd be the one who, you know, he played a role even in terms of taking people away from Imam Hussein alayhi salam in Makkah and other things. One of the reasons, one of the factors had to do with his relationship with his father and his broken home. And throughout this series, we've been talking about what are some of the deeper causes that lead people away from the ideals of Islam. They have the outward aspects of Muslims, but inside they have a deep sickness. And tonight I want to focus on this: relationships, homes, parents, and children. Now, first I want to offer some comments about relationships between husband and wife. And I know that some of you are not married, your children, right? Or for whatever reason, you're not married. But inshallah, I'm going to have some comments about parents and children as well. And even those who aren't married, sometimes it's good for us to plan ahead, right? Yesterday we talked about how marriage is something which is very important. It's something that, you know, is part of the sunnah of our Prophet. It's something that is one of the stages of development in our lives. One of the things that inshallah, right, we're going to have that rite of passage as well at one point in our lives. So tonight I want to focus on this, that what are some of these things that we can do to make sure that our relationships are strong, that we're building those families that are actually going to be successful, that we're doing our part in terms of having that environment where the children who come out of that environment, inshallah, will be a source of goodness. Not like Abdullah ibn Zubayr.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Matin شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا
Siyutu.
Çömen. Yani?
Bazaar.
Whether man-made or not, food can have fascinating backstories. Products usually take a long journey before they end up on the dining table. Nevertheless, the food industry follows several golden rules that have helped it steadily grow over time. The most important of these is continuous product innovation and improved production processes to reduce costs and wastage. Others involve packaging and product accessibility, but probably the king of all rules is the taste that drives the food industry.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the weekly program that analyzes markets, profits, industries, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we will be exploring the food industry and its related agricultural markets. We wanted to see how the food sector has expanded over the years and what companies are doing to increase their profits. So let's check out the Tasty Grub.
To become more familiar with how much work goes into food production, we visited Golha Food Industries. It was established nearly a century ago, and its products are now a household name. It produces hundreds of items in seven categories, such as dried legumes and fruit, spices and canned products. It also takes great pride in its healthy product line, including gluten-free flour products. This producer has devoted a lot of attention to the packaging of its products. Due to its diverse product list, it purchases such materials as cans, plastic, and cardboard to design the appropriate type of storage systems for distribution. The company has a massive daily output due to its expansive production facilities. Most of the work is done by automated machines, but the fine details are handled by experienced staff. All production processes start when raw material enters the company. These materials are first tested for quality before hitting the production floors, most of which are domestically supplied. After being tested, the material is sent to various closed circuit machines for processing. Then it is time for sorting and more quality control tests before packaging.
Food production is a very sensitive process requiring many checks and controls that guarantee the final product is safe for consumption. And production machines play an essential role as they reduce errors and maintain constant output results. Plus, many of these machines have been domestically engineered, whereas they were previously imported at high prices.
This company has a highly equipped quality control and research and development lab. It's where many new products are created and food safety standards are controlled. Moreover, the staff in this department implement food sciences to make innovative products. It might be interesting to know that this department also has some of the best food tasters. This producer has been awarded Best Research and Development Department in Food Production for many consecutive years. Among its many achievements, it has also been awarded the certificate of favored brand by customers. This wouldn't be possible without adhering to strict national and international food safety and production management standards. Following such standards has helped it maintain its export share in the global food market. With years of experience, this company has grown such that it provides thousands of employment opportunities, both directly and indirectly. It also has thousands of agencies and stores all over the country. Plus, its products can also be purchased online. As part of its future vision, this company is looking to increase its market share both domestically and abroad. It also has long-term plans to increase production and improve the production process for efficiency. The Iranian food industry has taken giant strides away from its traditional production methods. Industry participants say using food sciences and new technologies has helped the food industry grow faster than before. Never more than now has food been more accessible. In fact, it only requires a touch of a few buttons to receive it at home. Therefore, food packaging is a critical part of the production. Over the last decade, there has been a great emphasis on developing packaging for the food industry. This is because Iran indigenized many machines needed to process and produce food items such as deli meats, beverages, pickles, and so much more. Proper packaging also increases shelf life, which is important for consumers. Previously, food items such as spices and dairy products were purchased bulk from customers abroad due to a lack of packaging. While exporting items in bulk has benefits, it's not as profitable as selling prepackaged foodstuff. So, in addition to adding value to raw products such as meat, companies have also designed attractive packaging to contain food in more manageable portions. Such a strategy increases not only product quality, but also food safety, which helps producers meet international export standards. This trend also helps companies with branding and has created job opportunities for designers.
As you probably already know, the food industry is heavily dependent on production in the agriculture sector. So it's no surprise that the agriculture sector holds the pulse of national food security and food exports. Plus, it is one of the only sectors that has been barely impacted by the US-imposed sanctions and the global coronavirus outbreak. That was horrible.
We looked at some figures from the Ministry of Agriculture to see how this sector is doing. Last year, around 6 million tons of agricultural and foodstuff products were exported. Trade of these products raked in roughly $4 billion. Pistachio, saffron, and confectionery products topped the export charts in value during that period. Other agriculture sectors, such as livestock, poultry, and aquaculture, have also generated millions of dollars in exports. Last year, nearly 450,000 tons of these items were sent to markets in neighboring regions worth $500 million. Agriculture accounts for 8% of the country's gross domestic product. It might be interesting to know that around half of Iran's total non-oil trade comes from this sector. That's all based on data from Iran's Ministry of Agriculture. According to Iran's Customs Administration, the total non-oil trade value rose nearly 40% last year. Over 120 million tons of non-oil products worth $72 billion were traded with other countries in that period. Meanwhile, the government has implemented measures to encourage the development of agriculture. One trend this sector is witnessing is the application of smart technologies for the cultivation and harvest of various products. There has also been a boom in developing greenhouses and green practices to preserve natural resources. The word plastic was initially used to describe pliable and easily shaped objects. However, it only recently became a name for a category of materials called polymers. Such materials are abundant in nature. Take cellulose, for example. It's the material that makes up the cell walls of plants. However, synthetic polymers are a more recent invention of the last 150 years. These come from the plentiful carbon atoms found in fossil fuels. Since then, they have become an integral part of the industry, technology, and even various sciences. We will explore Iran's plastic and polymer productions. We will also check out some of its downstream markets and their contributions to the national economy. These days, we use more plastic than ever before. It's terrible. So where does this material come from? And what goes into making this stuff? Let's find out. Our quest for answers led us to a company specializing in making various polymer products. Parsa Polymer Sharif was established some 20 years ago and is a knowledge-based company that was born in the research department of the University of Sharif. As a leading advanced polymer compound manufacturer, it makes various products essential to everyday living. It produces compounds based on commodity thermoplastic resins like PP, PE, and the famous PET, or PET. It also engineers resins like PVC and so much more. This knowledge-based company is a major supplier of raw materials to many industries. Some include original equipment manufacturers in the automotive market and PVC pipe producers in the construction industry. Over the years, this company has helped Iran save millions on products that would otherwise be imported. This firm has three main functions: research and development, innovation center, and production. It also has a brand new line for researching and producing biodegradable polymers for the packaging industry. Most of the raw materials needed for production are domestically purchased. When this stuff enters the company, it is first tested and graded based on its quality. Then, according to its intended use, the raw material is formulated and sent to machines for production.
Machines used in the polymer industry utilizes some of the most advanced machinery for production. The extruder is one of the most commonly used machines. They play a central role in plastic production. Extruder lines are the largest converters of plastics worldwide. Some of these machines can be domestically manufactured while others are still imported.
Its products are all tested in its well-equipped research and development lab. The various granules and resin compounds undergo over a dozen tests while being analyzed for quality here. Also, new product formulas are created in this highly technical research and development department. Through these facilities, the company is expanding its product portfolio. Products made here are produced along the lines of exports. So, national and international quality standards are implemented during the production processes. This means the quality of products found here doesn't just match international standards, they go beyond the quality of competing foreign brands in the international arena. The headquarters of this company is located in Sharif University Advanced Technologies Incubator. Owing to this, It has strong relations and collaborations with the scientific community. It has also been awarded for its contributions to the scientific and industrial sectors over the past years. This knowledge-based company also exports its products. The company has a unique future vision strongly